caught up in danger in the middle of the storm. Hey, trying to run away from the fear that lies in the dark. Time to fight back, no turning back from the lion den that attacks. I'm a champion, a survivor. But we'll never, ever back down. I'll survive. Get my back against the wall. I'll survive. If I call it big at the night, I'll survive. Until the end of time, I'm a fighter.
Thank you for joining Strong to Survive. Today we are having a conversation with Hank Estrada as he tells his survivor story and shares with us some important information about how he became a strong survivor. Thank you for listening to our podcast, and if you'd like more information about Hank Estrada, you can visit his website at www.hankestrada.com. If you'd like more information about Strong to Survive, you can visit our website at www.strong2survive.org, strongtosurvive.org. Please enjoy the podcast, and have a great day. Welcome, everybody, to the Strong to Survive podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Hank Estrada. He's with us, and he is the author of Unholy Communion, Lessons Learned from Life Among Pedophiles, Predators, and Priests. It's a powerful memoir of overcoming years of assault and trauma. From the age of 5 to 16, Hank was molested by an uncle, tormented by an alcoholic father, and at the age of 21, while training for the priesthood, he was sexually assaulted by a predator priest. Hank is a graduate of Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California, and a seasoned media spokesman. In 1986, Hank founded the first national nonprofit organization to support male survivor healing. He is a respected author, recognized as an exceptional spokesman, a pioneer leader whose courageous story inspires hope for many worldwide. In 2010, he was among the exclusive audience of invited male survivor guests on The Oprah Show, entitled 200 Men Stand Together, which featured the actor and director Tyler Perry. Hank is a captivating speaker, consistently praised for his honest, straightforward presentations, whose courageous story inspires hope and healing. If you want to know more about Hank, visit his website, hankestrada.com. If you want to know more about Strong to Survive, you can visit our website, www.strong2survive.org, and please join me in welcoming Mr. Hank Estrada. Thank you so much for being with us, Hank.
Hello, Eric. Thank you. I'm excited to be here and to participate, and hopefully we'll get some really good information, support, resources for healing to listeners whenever they listen.
Absolutely. And yeah, as we were talking offline, this is going to be recorded. It'll be on iTunes. It'll be available on the Strong to Survive website, and I'll also share that link with you so you can put it on your website.
Fantastic. You know, it's exciting to know that after these are recorded, people can, at their leisure, in the privacy of their own home or office or wherever they have access to online media, can listen and still get the information without feeling that they have to be in a group or they have to be in therapy. These kind of podcasts are really, really the way to go for a lot of people who don't have, you know, readily available support networks around them or locally. So I'm excited to be part of it.
Well, we're definitely glad that you joined us. So just a couple of housekeeping notes for the people that are listening in. There are a couple of ways that you can interact with us. You can interact with us via Twitter at StrongToSurvive. If you want to ask a question for Hank, I'll be monitoring Twitter, and I'll make sure that I can feed those questions to him as well. Or if you're on the line with us here, you can definitely press 5-star. So at any time during the call, Hank has definitely made himself available. to be asked questions throughout the call. So don't feel like you're interrupting him. He's very open to receiving questions. So if you have a question at any time, you want to ask anything, feel free, press 5-star, or you can tweet us at StrongTOSurvive. So Hank, I wanted to start off, if you don't mind, we'd like to just kind of get the foundation laid with your story. And I know it's a very courageous story and you've been through a lot. And if you'd just like to kind of give us the foundation, let us know kind of what happened, what it was like for you, and just kind of start at the beginning for us, that would be great.
Sure. For the most part, what my experience, how my experience came out as far as telling my story and coming forward, I would never have done this had it not been for the fact that I learned that a nephew of mine was having some emotional problems at school. He was in elementary school. And it turned out that upon some investigations, the person who assaulted me as a child was at one time babysitting this nephew. And I put two and two together and immediately thought he must have attempted something with my nephew. So upon getting taking the time to investigate that and actually talk with my nephew, which, by the way, was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, was to talk to a, at the time he was 10 or 11 years old, to ask if uncle had touched him anyway or inappropriately. But he did share with me, yes, that uncle did do something and did touch him. So I was faced with the decision of whether to come forward and tell my story to my parents. And this was a brother of my dad's. And I just couldn't help but not tell what had happened to me, because now it had gone on to another generation and was affecting my nephew. So I confronted my parents, sat them down. I told them this is what happened to me years ago. I was about a freshman in college, I think, was when I first told this to my parents and disclosed it. It was very difficult, but I felt it was important to, in order to stop the abuse from continuing and to have the uncle removed and take care of the nephew's needs at the time. Unfortunately, nothing happened. There was no report. They chose to ignore it, and that's another part of the story. But what it did was, it was the first time I told my story and told my my dad specifically about what his brother had been doing all along. And it was from the age of 5 to the age of 16, and at which point I contemplated suicide because of all the difficulty I had trying to deal with feelings and emotions and the psychology of being traumatized, not only through the sexual assault, but through my my father's alcoholism and his violent temper. Those were very, very traumatic. I was lucky enough to find a local self-help clinic that I signed up for and started to speak more about it with counselors. And so that was the beginning of healing. And to this day, I tell everyone the way to start your healing is to tell your story, is to tell your experience. As long as you keep that to yourself, you're not on the healing path. You're protecting the abuser, you're protecting their story, and you're allowing them, unbeknownst to yourself, or maybe you don't realize, to continue. And that happened in my very own experience. I never said anything, and the uncle went on to assault a nephew. And I know there were more, there are many more nephews, cousins that this uncle had access to over the years. Some have come forward now, all these years later, now that they know that I've been an international spokesman on this, telling my story, and others still stay silent and quietly in their own shame. So that was what my childhood experience was. And then I had a second experience as a young college student. I was preparing for the priesthood, And one of my superiors in religious life was a predator. He is still a predator, still a priest, and protected by his religious community. But he groomed me just like my uncle did, with friendship and favors and compliments and attention that at the time I didn't realize I still needed much sensitivity and relationship, positive relationships. But being a predator, he took advantage of that, and I was assaulted as a college student by this man during the course of a summer that we spent together in Texas. And I reported him. I left the seminary, stopped my studies, and have been following this priest all these years. To this day, I still follow him and track him and hope that one day someone else, another one of his victims, will hear this story, read this story, contact me, and hopefully we can together get him permanently removed from his religious community and the safety and protection of them.
Wow, how horrifying. So, with regards to your uncle, so has he been prosecuted at all?
He was never prosecuted. He has since died. There are, as many survivors know, there who tell their story to their families, you'll have family members who will believe you, who will accept you and support you in any way they can, and you'll have family on the other side who will believe the perpetrator, protect him, and defend him as well. And that happened typically in my case. So to this day, there are people who feel that this uncle was the best person since butter for bread, sliced bread. And even knowing all the facts and telling the story, there remains denial. There remains people in the family who want to protect him and his name and his reputation even after he's gone, and who don't want anything to do with me or want to hear anything I have to say, which is fine. I mean, that's something you learn as you go along, and you when survivors tell their stories, it's always going to be that case where you'll have believers and you'll have non-believers. You'll have people who accept and then people who want to continue to deny. That's just the way it is. I don't know how to change that other than keep telling your story, and I keep doing that. So one of the important things I think survivors need to know who come forward like this is to realize right off the bat that there are always going to be people who question your motives, who question your honesty, who question your story. And you can't let that get you down. You can't let that stop you from continuing to speak. You just have to move on to the next person who will hopefully believe you. And I've spoken to many, many, many thousands of survivors over the years who tell someone they're not believed, and then they go back into their silence and their secrecy and their shame, and they just feel nobody's going to believe me. Well, you can't do that. It's exactly what they want you to do, to go away, to shut up, to be quiet, to be silent, be invisible. And I'm here to say we don't do that anymore. We can't do that anymore, and we won't.
I think that's a huge issue, especially with male victims and male survivors. You know, there's the fear of not being believed, and there's a reality also of not being believed. And also, yep, you know, the victim blaming. You know, it's like we get blamed for certain things. You know, I know when I came forward, I was told, well, if you were stronger, if you were more of a boy and less, you know, because I wasn't a typical, you know, boy, by all standards. I didn't play football. You know, I was more into writing and reading and different things. I was more to myself. I wasn't more outgoing and strong like the other boys. And so there's that victim blaming aspect of it as well. And
yeah. the interesting thing about that is not only is it from externally, from society and families outside of us, but it's also from within ourselves. Survivors ourselves feel, I should have done something better. I should have not let him do that. I should have fought him off. I should blah, blah, blah. All these things that we're supposed to have done. But the reality is we did what we were groomed to do as children. In that case, where child sexual assault is involved, we did as we were instructed to do by our elders. We did as we were expected to do, and that is to obey and to follow the lead and the instructions of someone who was more in control and more responsible for us. That's all we did. And when it involves sexual assault, it's completely confusing to males because there were things that happened in sexual assault. Many times it's just a natural response to feel sensations when you're touched mm-hmm. a certain way, when you're stimulated a certain way, and to experience just natural pleasure of physical touch. And that becomes a really big issue later on as for survivors, male survivors who are afraid that they may be gay or have turned gay or because they had these sensations that their body naturally responds to. So that's one issue. I'm getting off of it, but you were going to say.
Okay, sorry about that. Looks like we had a technical difficulty there. We got disconnected for a moment, and I apologize for that. Okay. Hank, are you back?
I'm back. I lost you for a minute there.
Sorry about that. Okay.
Was that me or you?
I don't know what happened. That was bizarre, but we're back. So that was short.
It just went silent. I don't know where I left off. Where did you get?
You were talking about survivors and self-blame and how that was kind of playing out, but...
Okay.
I was just going to ask
you have
that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a thought, you know, and I think back to that, when you were talking about we were just doing kind of what we were taught, the other part of it too, like in my case, I was doing what I needed to do to survive, you know, because in my
That's right.
case, if I wouldn't have gone along with it, I probably would have been killed, you know. So there's that part of it as well. For some people. And the self-blame, turning it on yourself, it's like, yeah, you're right. There is that natural physiological response to being touched. And I remember what you were saying. You were talking about the questioning of your sexuality when you are abused. So I'll let you go ahead and continue with that thought.
Well, the big thing, I think, and one of the problems that many men have who are not gay as adults or learn that they're gay as adults. Most gay men know that well and when they're young and don't maybe understand it as being gay orientation, but it just happens that they've known they've been different in childhood. Now, when the sexual assault happens, that throws a huge wrench in it, and you're dealing with society who some people think if you're assaulted by a man, you become gay. And if you're gay, it was because you were assaulted sexually as a child. But those myths are just, they're kind of being eradicated from the mentality these days, because once people, survivors, particularly men, realize that their bodies responded as normal bodies do, no matter what it is. If you have somebody who's blindfolded and they get touched and stroked, or their body will respond favorably if it's something that's sensual or soft or not violent. So the problem is for many male survivors who are not gay is thinking that, well, my body responded to that as pleasure and I was stimulated and I was aroused, and so that might make me gay. So I think just that fear And that confusion can often leads to substance abuse and chemical addictions and all kinds of behavioral compulsions that need to be addressed and directly learned about, because that's not the case. It's not a black and white situation, is what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Right.
As far as people's sexuality.
And that does lead us to a couple of tweet questions that we have on the line now. So the first question is, did you have nightmares as a response to the trauma that you experienced as a child?
That's an interesting question. I did not have nightmares because I was living them. The episodes with my father's violence, I was the oldest of five, so I was the one who would be stepping in between he and my mother when they were, when he was arguing with her and fighting with her and physically assaulting her. I was the one who got in the middle of that. And it was like being in a combat zone, because ultimately that experience from childhood was so bad that I was diagnosed with PTSD. In my early teens. That's how bad that was. So I didn't have nightmares. I was living them in reality. So I don't know if that was better or not, because but it just, that's how my experience was.
Okay. The second question, did you find that you turned to substances as a means to cope with the trauma?
I did not. I could have very easily turned to substances, being my family. There's a lot of alcoholism in my family, my father and his brothers, my uncles. And every weekend was a party. Every weekend was to see how drunk you can get, and which led to violence and arguments and physical fights. So seeing that as a child, I never wanted to be that way, and that really turned me off to considering or using any kind of substances. But I could see how that easily happens to people, to numb themselves or to change the intolerable environment that they have no control over as children. So, but fortunately, I did not do that. And for me, the sexual abuse and the confusion that it caused during my adolescence that led to an attempted suicide was because I was shamed for feeling that some of it was pleasurable. I was confused about my sexuality, and so it just was my difficulty was trying to find intimacy without the sex. But when someone, what I learned was, when someone would pay attention to me, when some male or female, when someone would give me a compliment, my immediate reaction was that I need to return the compliment in something, by something sexual, some sexual activity. That's what I learned as a child. So that, as you can imagine, became very problematic when your coworker praises you or your boss says something nice to you, that in my mind I needed to then perform something physical or sexual with them in response. So that was my problem in life, not the substance abuses. It was more behavioral.
Okay. Thank you for that. And the final question on Twitter right now is, do you have any children?
I do not have children. I have, many, many nephews, nieces, great nephews and nieces now. And it's not something I ever felt I wanted to do. I didn't know if I would ever be able to. I still wonder what it would have been like to have a son. And I guess that's something I won't know, because I don't plan on having children. I'm still not comfortable and in interacting with children, because I didn't know what that was like as a child. I was expected to be an adult at all times and be responsible. And so there wasn't much play, there wasn't much fun, there wasn't much laughter that I remember. So as an adult, I always felt awkward around children who were just being kids. So it wasn't meant for me.
Thank you for your honest answers. All right, that's all the questions in the queue so far. So I guess we can go on to whatever other topics you want to move forward to.
Sure, good questions. Now, the second situation, during college, and I mentioned that the grooming was very similar to how my uncle acted. So this predator priest decided to make me his a special project, I guess, one summer, and he would show me around the different community centers. We would visit senior citizen homes. We would go to the local juvenile detention center, pay visits to the incarcerated. We'd visit the jail. So he was using the guise of teaching me how to be a better minister, a better servant to the community, but at the same time was just heaping a bunch of compliments and praises, and it was looking back on it, it was like overkill. But I at the time needed to heal that. I was very inadequate, very unprepared for dealing with people's circumstances in life, that where they end up in incarcerated, or they end up in nursing homes or in hospitals and that sort of thing. So I needed all the support and encouragement I had, and this man sensed that and took advantage of that. And so people ask, well, how did that happen? It happened because he groomed me, and that was his forte. He knew exactly what he was doing and would treat me out to dinners and give me gifts and say what a great priest I was going to be one day. And that continued almost all summer. And then one day we were at a lake with a bunch of other priests and students, and he came around and started wrestling with me in the water, and I could feel he was excited physically and leaning against me, and that was really odd. I got out of the water, and it just brought up a bunch of issues for me, like that whole thing I was explaining about feeling I needed to reciprocate because he was being so nice to me. So that was something that I didn't understand at the time, why I was letting him groom me like that. But ultimately, it ended up 4th of July, one 4th of July celebration. We were alone watching the fireworks, and he made a pass at me, and it just progressed from there for the rest of the evening to a sexual relationship. And that continued through the rest of the summer. And at that time, being a young college student, I thought I had fallen in love, that this was love. Of course, I wasn't. And at the end of summer, he was sent off to the missions in Nigeria, and I wasn't told. And it was devastating to me because I was feeling all these emotional attachments and like I said, I thought I was feeling love and loved by him. I was devastated to the point that I had to go into therapy to deal with all of the confusion of what that separation was now causing me. Ultimately, it forced me to leave the seminary, but to stay in therapy and to address these issues of need and longing and the devastation of being separated like that was from somebody I thought loved me, but was not the case. So that was the second experience I had that I've learned still continues for this man who has gone on to have access to other communities. He's been around the world, different missions, Nigeria and India, and then he's been in charge of young men studying for the priesthood in those countries. So I know, I believe he's had a field day. And like I say, my day, hope one day is to hear from some of them, for them to hear about my story and experience. But so far, we haven't had any feedback yet. But I've tried over the years. Every once in a while, I'll get on Twitter, Yahoo, Facebook, and I'll put his photo out, I'll put his name, I'll put the name of the country that if anybody knows this man, contact me. I've had a few contacts, but they've been from religious members of the religious communities who were either around where he was teaching at the time, and they have nothing but praise to say for him. So there you go. I just don't have anybody who's saying we need to talk privately. So, but one day I think it'll happen. Has to.
Wow, that's just. I'm so sorry that that happened. And I mean, the worst part about it, I guess, is just the fact that it was swept under the rug, and you know that he was swept away, and nothing was done about it. I think that's the betrayal, you know, that happened there at that level is the worst part of it. I mean,
well, that's
that's not the worst part, but that's an awful part of it, I guess.
Right, right, and unfortunately, it doesn't make me any different or any special or any unique for that experience, because that's what we hear time and time again, all the time now, from everyone, not only just Catholics who were assaulted by priests, but you have prominent coaches who assault university students, and the university takes the side of the coach, and it just continues. It's really discouraging. But the one thing I really appeal to survivors is not to ever stop telling your story, no matter what the response is.
Right.
Because perpetrators are dependent on our being secretive and quiet.
Yep.
They rely on that. That's the very thing that gets them to continue. And
absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So we have to keep talking. We have to speak about it in order to heal it and in order to prevent it. I say to parents that you need to teach your children to always tell you things that happen to them with other adults or other people in that they're put in under their care. Even if it's innocent or not, they need to tell you, be taught to tell you what happened, and especially if it has anything to do with your being touched. I think that's for many of us in my generation who were taught to respect your elders, do what they said, don't question. Well, that just went on, and same thing applies for religious institutions. You follow your minister, you follow your priest, you follow your rabbi, et cetera, without question. You don't challenge them. And it's just that thinking, that mentality just led to a lot of the assaults and abuses. And it still does. So for parents, that's one of my biggest things to say. You teach your children to tell you when someone touches them in any way.
And I think it is important for people to keep telling their stories, because, you know, without that silence, then they lose their power. And that's why it was so important for me to create this podcast, to give
right.
that voice for
right.
for the survivors. You know, we have this platform now, and people can share. And even if they don't share, they can hear the courage, you know, that you have and that others that are going to be sharing on this podcast have to speak out,
right.
to know
right, right.
that there is that they're not alone, you know, that there is hope, that you can overcome
right.
the pain of the past, that you can do great things with your life, even if these awful things happen to you. You don't have to fall down into a pit and, you know, and end your life. You can move on. You can, You can find therapy, you can find healing, you can find hope, and you can do other things with your life, and you can help others. You can give others hope.
That's right. That's right.
So
I think another thing that's important from my experience in healing is that survivors get to the point. First and foremost thing is to tell what happened to you, and because your healing can only start when you start talking about it. It'll never happen if you keep silent. It won't. You'll just hang on to that. The second thing that's important is to forgive ourselves, not forgive the perpetrator, not to forgive the assault, the abuser, but to forgive ourselves, I think, is the second. And by that, I mean we need to understand that to forgive ourselves for staying silent all these years, for not telling about what happened, because when you realize that we've been quiet and shamefully silent, that just allowed us to protect the perpetrators. And so when you think about it, wow, that's not very good, right? That's not something to be proud of, that our silence has allowed them to continue. And in my case, it did. My silence allowed him to access my nephew. But it was by my so I needed to forgive myself for that and for unintentionally helping the perpetrator continue the assaults. And then also to forgive myself for acting as I was told to do, for acting and responding as I was groomed to do. That wasn't something that I invited or that I welcomed. And so sometimes it's subconscious that we hold a lot of guilt that is unnecessary, and it wasn't our responsibility. We were, as we said before, responding as we were trained to, told to, taught to, and expected to. So the forgiving ourselves had to do with, that's all we did. I forgive myself for doing that. And we don't talk a lot about that. Usually you hear any discussion on forgiveness having to do with forgiving the perpetrator. Well, that's a whole other topic. But in my experience, I did not I forgave to the point of, and this includes my father's lack of response and my family who support the uncle, that I forgave them for the space that they were in intellectually. In other words, I forgave them for understanding their limits about the subject, about the assaults, about the perpetrator, about molestation and all that. But what I cannot forgive is once you have that information that you continue to ignore and deny the seriousness of the problem. Do you understand the difference?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my little take on forgiving. People talk about you can't heal if you don't forgive. No, that's not true, because some people choose to continue denying, choose to continue protecting perpetrators, choose to ignore facts survivors' stories of their experiences, and that's unforgivable. It is. It's just the bottom line. That's unforgivable because it continues the assaults.
So it looks like we have two more questions. I don't know if this is a good place for us to get those.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the first question is, how do you deal with your PTSD today?
Well, it's been an ongoing thing ever since I learned I had it. The symptoms and the responses, and I had to learn what it was and what the results of living through those traumatic experiences did to my psyche and my mind, and then understand them, that they still can be triggered. They still can come up at any time. But for me, it's learning what those triggers were, what they are, what are the cause and effects of things that happened back then and things that happen today in my life now. Fortunately, I did not have an issue with substance abuse, and so that I wasn't numbing myself, and I had to face a lot of it just hardcore without any substances or medications, and realize that these were things, what I'm doing today or thinking today, most of it is thinking today, that I'm being challenged or I'm being set up or I'm being taken advantage of, whatever, and how they can go from one extreme to another. They could just be something subtle, something innocent, but I can take it a completely different way and extreme, where it's threatening to me, or it's causing me anxiety or panic attacks, that sort of thing. So it's really understanding what those triggers are, and then taking steps to improve how you react today. And that may, you know, how do you get over that? How do you detract from the triggers that are setting you off today? Find something that is healthier, that is more appropriate, that is more helpful to remaining in the here and now today, and realizing that, you know, you're surrounded by supportive people. If you have that, you're surrounded by healthy people, mentally sane people, and productive. And I think that's the biggest thing, is just surrounding yourself with positive contacts, resources, relationships. Anything that doesn't support that, you need to let go of it. And I say that is one of the hardest things for survivors to do, especially if you just have a small family or a small network. It's a situation we all have to face at some point or another, is that I call it getting rid of old baggage. And by old baggage, it could be your parent, your partner, your family, or anything that is not contributing to your mental health. Your positive mental health is something that we need to make the decision: do I want to continue with this and allow this to impact me negatively and maybe stir up the PTSD, or do I want to move forward and find a new resource or relationship that is healthier and more positive and encouraging?
That's great. Thank you so much. And the second question is, have you come across men who have been assaulted or abused by women?
I have. In my 30 years of advocacy work, that is always been the case for survivors of sexual assault, but it's not always been the case that they've come forward or been identified in any way or any study. So the studies on sexual assault survivors have been on women, or for men on men, males on males. But there is not a lacking of that population at all. We just don't hear much about it because of society's perception that, oh, if you were lucky enough to be, you know, a teen or to start having sex with a female, then good for you. It may, you know, but there's a lot of that in the military, that thinking. There's a lot of that, unfortunately, in the court systems. They just don't see it as on the same level as an assault of a 21-year-old man, 22-year-old man on a 10, 11-year-old boy. So it's whereas a 21, 22-year-old woman having sex with a 11 or 12-year-old boy, it's just, there's this little perception and mentality that it should have been fun and enjoyed and lucky, that person. So we still have that all these years later. It's something that, again, just telling the story that this is what happened and how it happened, if it's a female perpetrator, will eventually change that perception that, no, that isn't right. You know, how many times have we heard recently, Eric, about these teachers who are having, female teachers having sex with male students. And they're getting slapped on the wrist. There was one 2 weeks ago who just got probation and she lost her teaching license. But if you'd reverse that and it was a male teacher with a female student, he'd have been in prison as a sex offender for life.
Right.
So
yeah,
there's really...
That teacher had, she had multiple victims, didn't she? I mean, it wasn't just one.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, for sure. It wasn't her first time. And all she got was a slap on the wrist. That is serious injustice. And I always hope that people campaign against the judge who gives that kind of sentence. The judges, they really, in that case, are totally misinformed, really misinformed.
I think the queue is cleared now, so we can continue.
Okay. Let's see, what else did I have to say? I wanted to say, okay, the first thing I said was most important was telling your experience. That's the most important to start healing. The second thing was to learn to forgive yourself right off the bat. You may not even be thinking that, but when you think about what you did by staying silent was to allow your perpetrator to continue. Unintentionally, yeah, but you have to be aware of that. And then the other thing I would say is to men specifically, understand that our bodies respond physically to touch and stimulation, no matter who is doing it. And if you respond and you get excited and you get an erection, it doesn't mean you're gay. It's just your body naturally responding to touch. And once you realize that and know that it's not going to change your sexuality, then you can better deal with having had that experience of being assaulted by a male. It doesn't change your sexuality. It's not going to make you gay. And that's really important for men to realize right off the bat. That, yeah, you may have gotten excited, you may have been physically excited, but you may have been responded, you know, with an erection, but it has nothing to do with your sexuality, and that's really key. So stop thinking that, you know, your life has changed forever just because you responded physically to being touched by another man.
Absolutely. I think that's really important for survivors to understand because that's where a lot of self-blame does come in, you know, because I was aroused, I wanted it. And that's not true. Simply not true.
Of course. No, you didn't invite it and you didn't welcome it. That's the other thing. You never invited it and you never welcomed it just because you responded that way. It was just a physical response, not an emotional, not a psychological, not an orientation. It was a physical response to the circumstances. Now,
I equate that to going to the doctor and having your knee hit with that little hammer and your knee,
yeah,
your leg kicked out involuntarily.
Exactly. Good one. Yeah, that's exactly what it's like for many men who aren't gay. So, and you need to just remember that. Now, that can also cause a confusion in adulthood. And again, I say it's not a black and white subject, sexuality, gay versus straight or heterosexual. It's because it's very complex for some men to act out as adults by going for same-sex encounters or experiences after. Let me see, how was I going to say this? For some, it becomes a compulsion to continue acting out sexually with men, even though they're not gay. It's just something they learned, something they were groomed for, they were involved in that responds or takes the place of some other way of coping. In other words, it's something they learned they could do, and it's something that for whatever reason, makes them feel a certain way or makes them feel that they're coping by continuing that behavior. And that's where a lot of the gray, black and white discussion goes of why are men who aren't gay acting out sexually with other men? That's where we have problems with the increases in HIV and AIDS and in straight marriages and men acting on the down low, they call it, who are married but they're acting out with men. It's just, it really is a very complex dynamic that takes place in ways that men cope or try to cope with it. So, again, it's not saying that you're gay, but you happen to be still acting out that way.
Right. And I liken it to, you know, to substance abuse on the same level, because it's like an animal who has a wound in his paw and he keeps looking at that wound, trying to get that wound to heal. You know, it's like that. You know,
yeah.
That's kind of the response that an abused person has when they're acting out sexually. It's like they're trying
that's
to
right.
get this out of themselves, but they don't know how. And
that's right.
And left untreated, that's kind of where they turn, you know. And I did turn to promiscuity as a means to deal with my own sexual abuse, because I didn't know what to do at a young age. I was just so freaked out. I was, you know, I didn't know what to do.
Right.
And
right.
And in a similar manner to the way that you dealt with it, it's like, oh, someone's being nice to me. That means I need to go, you know, have sex with them.
Right.
And
that stays with you.
Yeah, because I wanted people to like me, because I felt like I was unlikable.
Yep.
So we have a question here. What advice would you give to a young man, male teen, young person listening right now who needs help, someone who is being abused right now?
First thing I'd say is to find someone that you trust, that you have confidence in, that you can tell what's going on with you, what's happening to you. That's the first thing. Find someone who will believe what you're saying, what you're telling them. Then try to figure out how to lessen the exposure to whoever's doing that to you. In other words, try to, if you can move out, if you can get away for a while, if you can get out of that situation or environment, do whatever you need to do to get that. And then the third thing is to call any one of the many hotlines that there are online and start talking to professional counselors online support groups. Those are the three things, is to tell someone until they believe you. Second thing is remove yourself from that environment. If you can, avoid it. And third is to start taking advantage of all the resources online now that are available to men and boys who are experiencing that, and see what advice you're getting and what's available in your community. For me, when I attempted the suicide, I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't tell a teacher. I didn't tell anyone. I got on the Yellow Pages. Back then, we had Yellow Pages, no internet. And I found an ad for a self-help support group in my city. And I called the number, and they invited me in. And that was the first step. That was my one chance. So I took it. So that would be my advice right now.
So the follow-up to that is, what if there isn't anyone they can trust? Should they turn to law enforcement?
That's a tough one, because not all law enforcement is prepared to deal with it. And it could be a really, really, really difficult situation to be in. In other words, it's your word against your perpetrator's word. And if your perpetrator is someone in the family, a parent, or someone prominent in the community, you're pretty much up against a huge, huge behemoth situation where law enforcement would be more apt to protect the perpetrator in that situation. But I don't say not to call law enforcement, but to just know that you may not get the response you need, unfortunately. So that's why I say start with the organizations like Male Survivor, like your group, any of the groups that are out there online, and see what advice you get, because there's plenty of it out there. So I don't have any one particular, and it may take a few times, a few tries, but that's need to do.
I agree, Hank. I think that you have to really kind of be careful with who you disclose to, because for me, I did disclose to law enforcement, and my stepfather was buddies with all of law enforcement in the town that I grew up in, and so I was not believed. And
nothing
happened as a result of it, and what it led to was years of stalking and torment, and nothing was done about that either. So, and it's not to discourage people from going to law enforcement. If you feel like you're in a situation where the law enforcement would be the best possible solution, and there isn't a situation like what my situation was, then absolutely go to law enforcement. But if it is a similar situation, then it's probably best to reach out to either an organization like Strong to Survive, 1 in 6 Male Survivor, or some sort of rape crisis center in your local area.
Absolutely. So you know firsthand what I'm talking about. And that's exactly what's important, what survivors, anyone listening needs to hear, is that side of the story, that side of the experience. It's not all going to be accepted. It's not going to all be believed. You're not going to get help. You have to just keep going and asking and telling again and again until you start making progress. The main thing is to remove yourself from any environment where that's happening right now, or that person, even if it's your parent. Move out. Move to a friend's. Get away. And that's what you need to do.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to have the understanding that while there isn't a lot of structure out there for male survivors, there are organizations currently working on building those infrastructures. So I think in the future things will change. As it stands right now, things are slowly starting to change. But for now, there isn't a lot. You know, unfortunately, there isn't a lot of support out there.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. We have to go wherever it's available and needed, and a lot of it is online. And even reaching out to, like, myself or to you, Eric, somebody, a teen right now who's listening, send us an email. Write us. Let us know. We'll talk to you. You know, we'll give you some support, and we'll share whatever we can to help you make the situation better and improve.
Absolutely. We are definitely, I mean, that's why we're doing this. We're here to support in any way that we can, and we'll definitely be there for anybody that needs it.
Right. But they have to take responsibility and reach out. We can't do it for them. And that's one of my other points I wanted to make about, as an adult, after you've overcome and you've survived, as adult survivors of sexual assault, we need to take responsibility for our day, for our behavior, for our actions, and to stop blaming our abuse history. In other words, there comes a point as survivors where saying I was abused as a child and it messed me up and, you know, did all this emotional stuff in my head, that isn't a free pass to act irresponsible in your adult life now, today. And by irresponsible, I mean continuing compulsive behavior, substance abuse, maybe violence against others, any of that. It's not an excuse. There is a point where we need to be responsible now, and we are in control of our present day lives. So that's the other thing I wanted to say, because I know survivors who use that
as an ongoing excuse to act out inappropriately, to act out violently, to act out just unhealthy. And that's no longer acceptable in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's something that my grandmother told me, you know, once she helped remove me from that situation. She looked at me and she said, Eric, you have a choice about the kind of person you can become. You don't have to let this consume you. You don't have to let it become you. You can choose to be something different. You can choose to be something better. And that stuck with me. You know, that really stuck with me.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because that was so long ago, but it still rings in my head and it reminds me and it keeps me going because I'm making different choices every day. And and here I am, you know, trying to do something different, trying to be something better.
That's the good advice, is to make it a point to seek out to make your life better than anything it was before. And take advice from people who've been there, like us, who are talking about it, and to make a difference in where your life goes now, from this point on, from this day forward. And that's fantastic. Your grandmother had that sense of security to share with you, because I can only fantasize about if someone would have told me that back then, how it would have changed my whole journey. It would have just been a lot easier to get to this point where I am now, all these years later.
Absolutely. So we still got some time if you want to talk a little bit about, you know, your book, maybe the nonprofit. I don't know if you wanted to get into those at all, but I've definitely enjoyed what you've shared with us so far. It's really been inspiring, and wow, I'm just in awe, and I'm so grateful for everything that you've shared with us today. So wherever you want to lead us for the next 20 minutes to half an hour, you know.
Sure, absolutely. Now we can talk about some of the current topics today with sexual assault in the military.
Okay.
That's coming out, men in the military who've been sexually assaulted. That's an area that I've been hearing more about. And being in New Mexico, where I'm at now, we have several bases, large bases here. So I'm trying to reach out to members of the military who may have experienced sexual assault or know somebody who has been sexually assaulted. We want to offer them support. And they're having the same situation, I'm hearing, where they report to their supervisors, they report to their seniors, and they're not believed, and the history of the assault is denied. The treatment they get is they're victimized all over again as well, and that has to change. They're trying to make a difference in that experience by telling what we know from our experience as just sexual assault survivors. It's similar to what's going on with the clergy abuse situation here in New Mexico. New Mexico was the largest, facility here in New Mexico for years for pedophile priests to be sent for supposed treatment. And that center has been closed, but years ago, in the 40s and 50s, when they were sending them, I think they stopped in the late 70s, early 80s, sending these priests to New Mexico for treatment. A lot of them stayed, and a lot of them were sent out to the American Indian reservations and pueblos to serve as their local priest, and the abuse and assaults continued there. We're hearing still now cases coming forward and records being released of how this. Again, the archdiocese and the bishops and the leaders in the church of the state just chose to simply move these predators on to other parishes without warning people. But it's not just New Mexico. But being here in New Mexico, that's what I've been hearing and learning more, that it just continued business as usual. And now we're hearing the same with the military. The military's, they're not reprimanding the predators in the military, some of them many high ranking, who take advantage of their positions and leadership to take advantage of low ranking military servicemen, are also just being shipped out and being moved, and that's really the tragic result of being ignored and denied any of this exists. And so we're faced with not only in religious life and religious communities and religions, but also now military bases and military personnel are now involved, and that it's being exposed more and more.
You know, that's an interesting point, because it makes me kind of question how pervasive in society, beyond just what is now being brought up, this issue really is. You know, I mean, this has been going on in military institutions for years and years and years without ever have been brought to the attention. And it had been going on in churches for years without ever been brought into the public consciousness. And
right.
It just kind of scares me to think how pervasive it is in other institutions and other parts of society that, you know, have yet to be exposed. And
right.
Really kind of, it's kind of frightening to think about.
You know, it could be overwhelming. It really could, because when you think about, here we are in the United States, and we have access to most anything online and reports and case files, et cetera, et cetera. And it's shocking to find out what's being revealed right here. But you think about, and I often think about the priest who assaulted me having carte blanche over in India or in South America or in the Congo, where he was, in the African Congo, as a missionary, where everyone believes and admires and puts these guys up on pedestals. They had carte blanche of their populations. And you know, you absolutely know that this goes on down there, even probably worse than we can ever imagine, because they know their victims will never speak out. Their victims will never report them. It's just that sometimes, if I let myself go there, can really get me, get my PTSD going. So at some point I have to stop thinking that, because I know that's the reality of what the kind of world we live in. I
right.
had some challenges by some associates who have taken on these campaigns in the last year or two to end sexual abuse in the year 2020, something like that, this campaign they started. And it completely surprised me, because I'm thinking, how, I don't know if it's naive or it's just out of touch, that you can assume to end sexual abuse by a certain year, when we have centuries and centuries and centuries of histories and victims and survivors' stories about it. It's just not possible. And I don't believe it will ever be stopped, because as long as you have people in authority, people in power positions, people who are superior to others, they will always be predators among them who take advantage of the innocent, always. The thing that I feel is making a difference is the voices of those of us survivors now telling our stories, speaking out about it, and not stopping and just continuing. Just keep it in their face, because that's the reality. And when I started, the one thing that I tell parents, you need to teach children, is to tell if they're touched in any way by anyone. That's the first thing, because until we start doing that, start teaching it, it's going to continue even more.
Yeah, and I think you made a really interesting point there. you mentioned as long as there's people in power and authority over others, this will continue. And I think it's important to differentiate sexual abuse and sex. Sexual abuse is about power and control and manipulation. It's never about sex.
No. It's been used for centuries. Battles in Roman times and before, and when one community would overpower another community, the men would rape men and women as signs of who's in power now. It's always been that way. I can only imagine what stories there are overseas, say in Afghanistan and Libya, where one group takes over another, or you have the militia or going into communities and devastating them. They're not just killing them. You know that. They're not. That sexual assaults are happening just as much, if not more, to the people that are overpowered. It's just how it's been. It's how it's always been. It's horrific. And we talk also about prison riots and things that go on in prisons, the same thing. You have the powerful and you have the weak. You have the strong and you have the subservient that get overpowered and sexually assaulted. Doesn't mean they're gay, but that's their one way of showing and exercising that power over others. It's just how it's always been, but it's keeping those that are in power exposed and supervised and just challenging their actions whenever we hear about abuses on any level.
So it looks like we have a couple more questions in the queue. First one is, when dealing with military abuse and even sexual abuse with clergy, do you think that, like letter writing campaigns to Congress, petitions, those kinds of things, do you think those are effective means of dealing with those issues?
They, in my opinion, they're effective in that the numbers of those coming in are dramatic examples of people that have been affected. In other words, if they see a pile of emails or a huge stack of letters, whatever, that immediately shows you numbers and the impact it's had on people's lives. As far as that making a difference, I really don't know. I don't have a lot of faith in politicians on either side, because they've all got their own motives for being in those positions. A lot of it has to do with power and gaining things for themselves versus their constituents. It's been proven time and time again. So I'm a bit of a pessimist on letter writing like that. So I wish I wasn't, but it's been my observations over the years. I don't know. So sorry about that one.
And then the other question, so our organization, our parent organization, plans to start going into schools and doing some educational talks in the future. What advice would you give us as we go in, especially talking with boys about safe touch and talking to their parents? Any kind of advice you could give us about that?
I think if you're going to go into schools and talking to young men and boys, I think it's important to approach the topic of sexual abuse, first of all, by saying, encouraging boys to know that they can say no when somebody touches them that they're not comfortable with. The first thing. The second thing is that they should feel encouraged to tell someone they trust that they've been touched
or made to feel uncomfortable by someone. They either know or don't know. That's also important, is to describe to boys that there are some people in our families who might want to touch us and make us feel uncomfortable. And we need to tell our parents or someone when that happens, that it's not just a stranger, not just, you know, somebody you don't know. It most of the times when somebody gets sexually abused or assaulted, it's by somebody they know. And so somehow addressing that very fact is key, I think, in educating boys not to be blindsided by thinking that it's somebody they don't know. Most likely someone they know and somebody they care about or who cares about them might touch them and make them feel uncomfortable, and they need to let somebody else know when that happens. When have you heard that in a presentation?
Yeah, I remember it being more about strangers, actually, when I was a kid.
Always. So that's the key. That's the key, and that's the reality to making a difference in if you're going to be doing this, is to start off right off the bat, that someone you know could touch you and make you feel bad, make you feel funny, make you feel awkward, whatever. And it could be someone you care about. But if that happens, you need to tell. I think that's a new campaign you really might want to consider developing. Forget the stranger stuff. Forget the stranger. Now we know, you and I personally know, that it's somebody who you care about or knows you.
Right.
Or lives with you. That's the new campaign. That's the new target, is to right off the bat, start right there. I think that'll make the difference. That'll get the conversation going even more.
Thank you so much for that advice. So looks like we've got about 10 minutes. Any last words, wise words, anything you want to share before we wrap up and share your contact information?
Well, I am offering to your listeners in the United States a free copy of my book, signed if they like. All they have to do is contact me through my website, hankestrada.com, email me, it's hankestrada@yahoo.com, and request a book that is Unholy Communion, Lessons Learned from Pedophiles, Predators, and Priests, about my experience as a child and then as a young adult and then as a survivor afterwards. Now, the book is free to anyone who asks, but I ask for a $5 shipping and handling charge to cover that cost. But otherwise, it's a $20 book. So for your listeners in the United States only, I'm offering that deal. So
wow, that's very generous. Thank you.
I think most of the points that I wanted to make, I think I've made. So one of the things I'm trying to do in New Mexico, where I'm at, is we're trying to start a local network of resources for survivors of clergy abuse, military assault, and just sexual assault, because there isn't anything set up on a regular basis right now for men here in New Mexico. And if that's your community, you may want to take a look and just see what we're trying to do and see if someone has the interest or expertise to do something similar in a community that doesn't have the resources either. But we need to take advantage of those online sources that offer counseling and support, direction, reading materials, anything like that is really important to utilize. So I encourage listeners to check out our websites for those resources.
Absolutely. So if people want to contact you, your website is hankestrada.com.
Correct.
Any other ways that you'd like to be contacted?
And then there's also the email address, hankestrada@yahoo.com. Be happy to email and correspond.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing your morning with us and your honesty and your candidness. It was truly an honor to have you on our show today, and very grateful that you took the time to do that. Hope to maybe have you on again sometime, and very, very grateful to have you today.
You're very welcome, Eric. I appreciate the opportunity, and I wish you all the best, and to all the listeners.
Thanks, Hank.
So you're
welcome. If you want more information about Hank Estrada, you can go to his website, hankestrada.com. If you want more information about Strong to Survive, our organization, our website is www.strong2survive.org. You can find us on Twitter, Strong, T-O, Survive. You can find us on Instagram, Strong, the number two, Survive. You can find us on Tumblr, Strong, the number two, Survive.tumblr.com. We also have a podcast, which you're listening to. It's on iTunes. You can search for Strong to Survive. I hope you all enjoyed this show. If you would like to share your story, please email us, info@strong2survive.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope you all have a great day. Goodbye.